This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the 2008 DeWitt Higgs Memorial Lecture. Thank you for coming. I'm Stephen Adler. I'm the provost of Earl Warren College, also a professor in the Department of Theater and Dance, but coincidentally, director of the Law and Society interdisciplinary minor here at UCSD. I have a list of people I would like to acknowledge for their participation in making this evening's event happen, and it's as long as a list of biblical begats, so please bear with me. I would like to, of course, thank and offer this evening to you on behalf of our Chancellor, Marianne Fox, Senior Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, Paul Drake, the Dean of the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies, Peter Cowie, Gordon Hansen, Director of the Center on Pacific Economies, Interim Dean of Arts and Humanities, Eric Van Young, Interim Dean of Social Sciences, Jeff Ellman, Dean of California Western School of Law, Stephen R. Smith. They all join me in welcoming you to the lecture this year, as is annually, sponsored by Earl Warren College. And this year, the Center for Pacific Economies, and as always, our partners, California Western School of Law. The Higgs Lecture presents the UCSD and San Diego communities with an evening of what we hope is stimulating discourse on a legal topic of contemporary importance. We believe that tonight's lecture by Professor Jerome Cohen of New York University will accomplish the goals of the Higgs Lecture in exemplary fashion. It's now my pleasure to introduce Professor Susan Shirk, the Director of the Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, and professor in the Department of Political Science here at UC San Diego, and the first appointee of the Ho Mu Lam Endowed Chair in China and Pacific Relations in the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies. She first traveled to China in 1971. During 1997-2000, Professor Shirk served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs. Her latest book, China, Fragile Superpower, was published by Oxford University Press in April 2007. My great pleasure to introduce Professor Susan Shirk.
And now it is my honor to introduce to you Professor Jerome Cohen. And it is a great honor and pleasure for the Graduate School of International Relations Pacific Studies to be hosting Jerry Cohen and his wife Joan Libold Cohen for the month of March here at IRPS, where he is a Pacific Leadership Fellow of the Center for Pacific Economies at IRPS. Professor Cohen is a person that I admire tremendously, not just because of his wonderful educational history and pedigree of being a graduate of Yale College and Yale Law School and editor of the Law Review at Yale, and then clerking for not one but two Supreme Court justices, Chief Justice Earl Warren and Justice Felix Frankfurter, but that he went on to develop the field of Chinese law at a time that nobody was studying Chinese law. He was really a pioneer and led the East Asian Legal Studies program at Harvard for almost two decades and opened up the whole field of Chinese law to us in the West. Then, with the death of Mao Zedong and the advent of the Deng Xiaoping era and the beginnings of market reform and opening in China, the People's Republic of China actually started creating a lot more laws than they had had in the Mao era. And Jerry Cohen was one of the people they turned to help advise them when they were creating these new legal codes. He went on to practice law, advise business clients, and participate in this very exciting opening up of the Chinese economy. But what I really admire about him is at the same time as he has advised international business people, he also has been very, very active in the cause of legal rights and human rights in China, and has advised families of political prisoners, people who have been detained in China, and is working very, very hard to promote the development of a real legal system and real human rights in China. So it's a great pleasure to have him here with us this month and to hear him speak this evening, not just about whether or not there is actually law in China, but whether or not there is justice in China. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. I hope my obituary is as kind. I remember in 1972, when we made our first visit to China, I was lucky enough to have dinner with Zhou Enlai, Prime Minister. And he was a clever fellow who made a little fun of what I had been doing. He said, "I understand you've written some books about our legal system." And he said it in a way that suggested perhaps I had made more of their legal system than China had. And obviously, he knew a lot more about it. Well, I'm very grateful to come out here and be a leadership fellow, and I'm especially pleased to give the Higgs lecture. As Steve said, tonight's theme seems consonant with the life of DeWitt Higgs and his concern for fairness and justice. And that's certainly a very prominent concern in China, and I'm grateful to all the other sponsors and get acquainted further with the variety of experts at this university who know a huge amount about various sides of the elephant, as we say. We're all trying to understand China, and it's a collective effort, which is probably commensurate with the ideology of the subject. It's also very good to have the sponsorship, among others, of the Earl Warren College, because my first job out of law school, as you've heard, was with the Chief Justice. And occasionally, on Saturday afternoon, he'd relax and let his hair down and talk about what life was like, rising to be Attorney General and then Governor of California, before he came to the very difficult and different task of being Chief Justice. And now to come to Earl Warren College is, for me, a rather moving thing. Well, I could go on thanking the Center on Pacific Economies and all the other sponsors, including Cal Western and the Law and Society Program, but I think that's not why you came here. Now, before starting on this review of where China has been with respect to law for the last 30 years, I think it's important to recall that in our own society, the struggle for justice and human rights and constitutional implementation is an ongoing, never-ending process. And we now stand before the world charged by many, including very recently the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, former Supreme Court of Canada Justice Louise Arbour, of having seriously violated international standards. I don't purport to say that the Chinese legal system and the American legal system are comparable in this regard. We have many serious problems. I'm just saying we should keep them in mind. But they're not as totally systemic as they are in China. China is confronting a much larger challenge, and I'm hoping to give you enough basis so that we can have a discussion afterward and maybe incite some of your interest. China is very, very sensitive about the subject of its legal system. This is a hot time for this topic. Although most people in China are much more interested in and excited about the Olympics coming up, which is a source of enormous pride, and the government obviously wanted to have the Olympics as a boost, a kind of legitimation of its achievements and international status, the fact is, the Olympics are coming at a higher price to China's leaders than they anticipated, perhaps. And many people, not only Mia Farrow and Steven Spielberg and others, have been calling attention to the fact that the implementation of human rights in China has not lived up to the promises the Chinese government made in seeking to win the Olympics. Indeed, just to express in public in China today that the government should be concerned with human rights and not the Olympics is enough to land you in jail. So this will continue to be a hot topic in the months between now and August. And maybe what I say will give you some background. The Chinese government just last week issued a white paper, a very long document, detailing its progress toward the rule of law in China. So they were anticipating, I think, the annual U.S. State Department report, evaluating how various countries of the world are doing on human rights. That report, normally out at the end of February, as far as I know, hasn't yet come out, but it perhaps will be out any day. Usually, China waits to answer that report, but this year, I think it's so sensitive that it didn't want to wait, and this is kind of in anticipation. Well, what can we say about this? China has many problems as well as enormous progress. We all tend to read about the economic development in China, and our media try to inspire fear and concern that the Chinese soon will be sucking up all the resources of the world and will be taking over various markets, including the American market. What they often lose sight of is that many of these aspects of progress have also brought huge problems to China, as well as the ones that the regime inherited in the country of 1.3 billion, still largely very poor and uneducated people. But the regime has to cope with enormous questions like problem of migratory workers. You have 100 million, maybe 120 million, I'll be interested to hear what our local experts say about that, workers who've come from outside the cities looking and obtaining short-term jobs. You have an enormous increasing gap between rich and poor in China. You're getting two Chinas, and this is creating enormous tension. Environmental problems are huge and perhaps overwhelming. Health problems are very, very severe in China. Access to social security for a society that retires its workers young is an increasing difficulty. Education, still, although the government is putting more funding into it, remains an undernourished enterprise in China. And access to it is very, very crucial for people. Land, property, forced eviction from your urban home, losing your property rights to rural farmland at unfair prices, that's become a dominant problem. Corruption is endemic in China, including corruption relating to the judicial system. So the problems are more serious than the foreign business community tends to see. But the foreign business community also has many questions, as some of you have told me earlier today. Now, all of these things involve the legal system. Some of these things can't be cured by the legal system, by any legal system. And China's legal system is really still new and fledgling. That's because it only really got off the ground beginning late 1978. The first 30 years of the PRC's history, 1949 to 78, really didn't feature a serious continuing effort to build a legal system. Much of it was dominated by this great charismatic leader, Chairman Mao, many of whose policies were antithetic to the growth of a legal system. You had mass movements, the Great Leap Forward, the anti-rightist movement of the late 50s, culminating in the Cultural Revolution of 66 to 76. It was only at Mao's death and the gradual ascension of Deng Xiaoping that the legal system began to be turned to, as the leadership decided to de-emphasize, perhaps do away with class struggle, and emphasize economic development, prosperity for the people. The legal system began to be one of the focal points of the new effort. What kind of a legal system have they developed? Today, the Central Committee of the Party finished a meeting just prior to the National People's Congress annual session that will open in a couple of hours in Beijing for a 13-day session. People are waiting to see what actions will the National People's Congress take to strengthen the Chinese legal system, to show that the leaders who give lip service to the rule of law rhetoric actually mean business. Essentially, you could say there are four questions we should look at tonight. One is there law in China? Of course, there's lots of law. Second question is, do they have a legal system? They definitely have a legal system. But the third and fourth questions are more difficult. Is there, in a meaningful way, a rule of law in China? And finally, is there justice in China? And can there be, unless there is a meaningful rule of law? So let me say a few words about the first question. In the last 30 years, I think the Chinese government has made as much progress in developing legal norms, in enacting legislation, regulations, not only at the national but also at the local levels, as much as any other country in history has done in a comparable time. The laws obviously aren't perfect, but this is an enormous achievement by a relatively small elite that has put these rules out there in the hope increasingly to guide society in handling many of the problems, not all of which I've had time to mention. Norms include international agreements. China has adhered to all the major multilateral agreements that affect international business. The WTO is only the most recent, and China is still adjusting to its obligations under the WTO. Bilateral agreements supplement this very, very much. China has, with all countries, including our own, a huge network of bilateral agreements on everything relating from consular obligations, treatment of foreign nationals in China, to nuclear arrangements and many other, treatment of foreign investment, mutual protection of investment agreement, tax treaties, for example. This is a substantial achievement. We shouldn't underestimate it. But norms don't enforce themselves. Laws, including China's constitution, need institutions to have them implemented. You have to have procedures. You have to have trained, skilled personnel. And China, starting a little later than it might have, has done an impressive job now in training personnel, beginning to staff the institutions and procedures that are required, resurrecting the court system after having been demolished during the Cultural Revolution, resurrecting the prosecutor's office, the Ministry of Justice, other law-related regimes. The legal profession has been brought back. You have a huge number of people, as I said briefly yesterday, who didn't exist in 1978. Maybe 200,000 judges, 160,000 prosecutors, 140,000, 150,000 lawyers. Huge number of people who staff the National People's Congress and local legislatures, every government, ministry, agency, commission, any big enterprise, whether state-owned, private, or mixed. Wherever you look now, you can find legal expertise. So you have a series of overlapping elites that share an increasing commitment to having a genuine legal system. And you have tremendous achievement in legal education. When we first went to China, there was no legal education going on. Today, you have 625 law departments and law schools. You have terrific learning. You have 100-odd law reviews that have real content. When they started out in the early 80s, they never amounted to much. Now you have real books written by able scholars taking on genuine problems. And you also have, for the masses of people, how to do it books. If you want to not consult a lawyer, but go into court yourself, you can go to the Xinhua bookstore and buy books that tell you how to handle civil procedure, how to get review of an adverse administrative ruling, how to take part in criminal procedure. Some of these books are very detailed and surprisingly helpful. All of this is really impressive. However, it leads to the question, is this legal system creating what we would call a rule of law? Rule of law is a slippery term. There are dozens of definitions, but I think the simplest and best is government under law. Is the government, and in China is the Communist Party, subject to the rules that are being promulgated, and including the Constitution, which is rather ambiguous, on the one hand giving the impression of having a lot of freedoms and rights and saying there shall be no interference with the courts, and on the other hand saying the guidance of the Communist Party is essential. And you have this ambivalence throughout the attempt to make the legal system work. The leaders of China, 4 days a week, talk about the socialist rule of law. They put property rights and human rights in the Constitution. They stir up expectations among the masses of people that there really is a legal system that will protect them. And then 3 days a week, they say, don't take this too seriously, because that's all Western bourgeois stuff. We are going to have our own rule of law with Chinese characteristics. And many people, when they hear that with fear and concern, because they know that means it's not a genuine, consistently adhered to rule of law. So Chinese, for example, have imported an adversary system in principle, but in practice, it's very hard for them to implement it. It's interesting to compare the effort in Taiwan in the last 20 years. Since democracy gradually began to bloom in Taiwan, they have really, despite the fact they are just as much part of Chinese political legal culture as most of the mainland, they have really made a serious effort, and they've had lots of problems because they've made a serious effort to implement an adversary system, where in trials, the prosecutor and the defense are treated as equals, where if the police want to detain you, they have to go before a judge and justify it. And if they want to extend your detention for a longer period, there's going to be another hearing before a judge. with lawyers present to defend the defendant. There are many things going on in Taiwan that may or may not foretell China's forthcoming success in implementing its promises of the rule of law. Obviously, the political system is now very different, but even Chen Shui-bian, the outgoing president in Taiwan, who's very much hostile to the mainland, has said, "We're all people of Chinese culture, woman doucher hua ren." And so there's much to learn in Taiwan about some of these questions. Maybe the biggest problem with China and the rule of law is the court system. In the 80s, most of us who were doing business with China didn't pay much attention to the courts. We tried to keep away from them. But in the 90s and more recently, we found it's impossible. You have to come to grips with the courts. Even if you choose to arbitrate disputes instead of settling them in court, if you win in arbitration and the losing party thumbs its nose at the arbitration award, you generally have to go into a Chinese court and get the court to enforce the award, make the other party pay up. It's very hard to do that consistently. The courts, although they're getting better in some places, particularly on the eastern coast, in the urban areas, not the rural areas, the courts in many cases are trying hard to improve. But it's very difficult to be a judge in China. You don't really have any independence. You're subjected to an endless array of pressures, phone calls, letters, visits, by people who might be the local party leaders, by people who might be cousins, relatives, business friends, by temptations of corruption, some put through the lawyers, some through other intermediaries. Local protectionism, if it's a dispute between a local company and people from outside the area, whether foreign or Chinese, local interests often prevail. There are many, many problems in fair adjudication in China, and some progress is being made. Also, ironically, the courts are a very weak institution. Chinese communist government is supposed to be a dictatorship. We think they have the power to order people to do things. The fact is Chinese courts are far weaker than our own. It's not easy in America to get a judgment enforced in some cases. But in China, it's very difficult. The courts simply don't have the power. A few years ago, the Supreme Court of China announced that this year will be the year of enforcing judgments. But what about next year or last year? It's very hard to make the system work. It's hard to get witnesses to come to court, whether it's in a criminal case or a civil case or administrative. An overwhelming number of cases, witnesses do not appear in court. And even though in 1996, criminal justice reforms, defendants were given the right, and their lawyers too, to cross-examine witnesses, it's proved to be empty because the witnesses don't turn up. And nobody makes them turn up. And this is one of the problems now confronting China as it's going through another round of revising its criminal procedure law. Perhaps there'll be some progress by the end of the year in legislation. But last time there was progress in 96, some of the progress never got implemented. The system has its own will, and the party has its own way of making the system work to its needs, not to those necessarily expressed in law. So theory and practice are often very, very different. Of course, if you don't have a genuine rule of law, it's very difficult to have justice aided by law. Now, of course, justice in society often has little to do with the courts and prosecutors, etc. So many problems of justice are social justice. The gap between rich and poor, I mentioned before, many environmental problems, problems of migrants, health, education, land, justice can't come only through the courts. Nevertheless, all these problems relate to the legal system. Even the problem of the gap between rich and poor. There's a lot of discussion in China today about the use of tax policy to try to alleviate that. Should there be tax rebates, or should there be financial grants direct to every person in China, 1,000 yuan perhaps, apiece? But tax legislation can also be helpful, at least in removing some of the taxes, as happened with respect to agricultural taxes. And of course, there's an enormous amount of litigation now about the right not to be discriminated against. If you're a blind person, or a poor person, or a person from another province, or a person who's got AIDS, or hepatitis B, and there's a gradual attempt to enforce constitutional rights. Under the political theory of the PRC, inherited from the old Soviet Union, courts do not enforce constitutional rights. Constitutional rights are enforced and interpreted by the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress. But they haven't done that yet, although the demands are growing upon them to do so. And sometimes they have to think of imaginative ways to avoid having to make a constitutional decision. But nevertheless, society doesn't wait. And every day in China today, litigants are going before courts demanding fairness, demanding that equal protection of the law be given to women as well as men. This is a fascinating effort, and courts are beginning to respond, sometimes overtly, more usually by finding ways of not mentioning the Constitution, but giving relief to the plaintiffs. One of the biggest problems in China today is really police power. What you have in China is the unfettered power of the police to put you away for 3 years or even four without asking anybody's approval other than the police. It's called Lao Dong Jiao Yang, and there are variants on that for people who are drug offenders or prostitutes or other people with special provisions. But the essence is the police themselves can put you away. This has aroused enormous opposition in China and, of course, criticism from abroad. And one of the major reasons Chinese government is hesitating whether or not to ratify the UN Covenant on Civil and Political Rights is such ratification would make continuing police power to put people in prison without judicial review untenable. It would be a violation of China's international norms. The Minister of Public Security has long opposed any change. But the Minister of Public Security has now been promoted to the Standing Committee of the Party Politburo, as I said yesterday. And he's in charge of the Party Political Legal Committee that coordinates all legal activities, coordinating what the courts do and the prosecutors and the lawyers and every other legal official. And they've been fighting so far a successful rear guard action to keep re-education through labor. This is one of the touchstones. You see, reforming the criminal procedure law won't make any change in re-education through labor because they say this isn't a criminal sanction. It's an administrative punishment. Therefore, you can get it without any of the protections of the criminal procedure law. And many people in China, as well as out, think that this kind of logic is really inconsistent with the real situation. If you get re-education through labor, you get something that looks just like criminal punishment, even though the name isn't used. And there are all kinds of proposals now to abolish it, to modify it, try to make it more palatable to people. But if you have the Ministry of Public Security and the Party Political Legal Committee against you, it's hard to make progress, and this bill to abolish reeducation through labor has been dead in the water for the 4 years that it's been before the National People's Congress. Well, there are many things going on in China where you can see there's a struggle underway. It's not simple. And of course, the key element is the Communist Party. But the Communist Party itself is not static. It's being subjected to the same kind of pressures from its membership that are being generated by the populace generally and by outsiders foreign to China. One of the interesting things that's little noted so far, China, I think the party has probably 73, 74 million people. The party must get the support of its own members to retain its own legitimacy. And in order to do that, you're getting ideas of judicial due process, fairness now being imported into the Communist Party rules. So that, for example, before a party member is fired, ousted from the party, the party member A must know what the charges are, why it's happening. B, what's the evidence? C, there must be a hearing. D, he can ask, he or she can ask for another party member to help as an advisor, a kind of de facto defender. D, or E, if there's an adverse decision, they have a right to reasons, to know why the decision was made. And finally, they have a right to appeal. Now, these are plainly judicial ideas that have been imperfectly imported into the formal legal system. But I'm not talking about the formal legal system now. I'm talking about the way the party administratively treats its own members. And maybe this is a sign of optimism we can see. Because if these rules really begin to be implemented, it will certainly speed the momentum of efforts to implement these more broadly. There is also increasing concern about the Party Discipline and Inspection Commission. That is a party agency that whenever there's an accusation of corruption against any significant party leader, that agency takes over before the criminal formal process begins. And this was highlighted when the Shanghai Party Secretary, Chen Liangyu, was taken in, and he's disappeared, taken in by the Discipline and Inspection Commission, which could take months, years, to make its recommendation. Most people don't get sent to the criminal process, but they do suffer party sanctions, maybe loss of membership. But maybe 15%, perhaps more, are recommended for criminal prosecution. But they've already, these subjects, have been deprived of their rights to see their family, to consult counsel, more completely than anything under the criminal justice system. And more people, including party people, are complaining that the Discipline and Inspection Commission of the party should not have this kind of power. But, as I said yesterday, without leadership from the top, all of this progress that's been made in the last 30 years, all of the legal education and training and all the new judges and prosecutors, etc., all of this isn't achieving too much because there's no party leader who has the imagination or the sensitivity or the priority for law or the power to give support to these hundreds of thousands of people who are earnestly striving for a better legal system. And the formal legal system, when someone gets into its clutches, really divides into two types. Often it will operate according to the rules, but often, especially during times of mass political movements, strike hard movements to suppress crime, for example, anti-Falun Gong movements, or similar efforts to suppress other dissident groups, to suppress democratic activists who want to form a democratic party for China, for example. These formal rules are suspended. And then low visibility informal measures are taken. And increasingly in China, people are being harassed. They're being subjected to all kind of abuse, sometimes even torture, occasionally death, by informal means. Sometimes the police don't even want to dirty their hands with it, but they hire thugs to do their dirty work. And I've been involved in some cases of this nature. These cases are heartrending, many of them. We've seen many just in recent weeks. You'd think the regime would be trying to show in the period before the Olympics its better side, but it's so eager to repress any public criticism that might mar the Olympics that it's achieving the ironic counterproductive effect of marring the Olympics by the fact that these things can't be kept secret, even though they're often of low visibility and supposedly unofficial. I just want to mention one case that I feel obligated to do so because this man is a friend of mine. There's a blind man named Chen Guangcheng, who is what we call a barefoot lawyer. He never went formally to law school, but because of the fact he felt so strongly about discrimination against blind people and other disabled people in rural Shandong province, he became a legal activist. He bought some of these books that tell you how to do it. I bought him $100 worth of these books several years ago, and he's made good use of them. But he got so involved and so upset about violation of the rights of women who were subjected to forced abortion and sterilization, which in some Chinese provinces has been revived in recent years, that he became persona non grata to the local authorities, especially after giving interviews to Time magazine and the Washington Post and other foreign media. And he's been condemned on frivolous grounds and sent to prison for 3 years and 4 months and treated cruelly, as has his wife and children, family. That's another nasty thing that's been revived lately. Chinese traditional imperial justice used to have collective punishment. If you committed a political violation, your whole family, sometimes several generations, would be obliterated. In practice now, this is beginning to happen. People who violate the strictures of the regime not only suffer themselves, but their wives, children, parents, etc., are also struggling. There's a lawyer in Shanghai who's been terribly abused, Zheng Enchong, whose daughter had to come to America, even though she doesn't know English, because she was told there's no future for her in Shanghai, and she wasn't allowed to go to the university for which she was qualified. A lot of this is happening below the visibility of the media, especially since the media is, by and large, not always controlled. The media would be a very valuable tool for law reform in China. And, of course, lawyers. The lawyers who take part in human rights cases, the lawyers who are courageous enough to defend people who need defense in politically sensitive cases. These people are crucial, and yet they're severely restricted and controlled. And they themselves are divided. Some of them say, we have to take part in political reform, not just legal process, because there'll never be a true legal system. There'll never be real legal justice without political reform that will curb the powers of the party. Others say, look, that way lies prison. We have to use the available processes, even if they mean one hand is tied behind our back as we try to defend people. I've taken part in conversations with people, including the famous Gao Zhisheng. And when he said we have to have political reform, I said to him, I admire you. I know you're right in principle. But as a result of your attitude, you won't be around next year. You won't be available to help anybody. And that is true. He has been taken care of so that he's no longer playing a significant function. Well, time is up, but I wanted to give you a sense of the ferment in China. It's not easy to answer The future is uncertain. There's a struggle underway, a struggle between hundreds of thousands of people who, in different ways, trying to keep themselves out of harm's way, nevertheless hope to be constructive in the law reform process, and people who believe in the name of stability, in the name of harmony, we've got to keep the lid on, and repression is the way. We don't know how this struggle is going to end. Foreigners, I hope, will continue to play a role in fostering the law reform effort in China. But inevitably, our role is very minimal. All we can do is help around the margins, but we should do that. The real future of China will be determined by the Chinese people, by the next generation of leaders. And many of you who come from China will have to decide, will you go back and what will you do? This is a very great challenge, and I'm very happy to see that the University of California at San Diego is doing a lot to train leaders for the next generation in China as well as elsewhere. And I think it behooves all of us to do what we can to foster this process. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.